You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One in London. I am Markus Hippi. On today's show, from Pakistan to Ukraine, journalists Samira Shackle and Darren McCaffrey will discuss the biggest stories of the day. Plus,
well, there we're looking down on the Alps now, the high mountains of today's stage of the Tour de France, and the field is spread up.
We will take a look at the ones who rarely get any attention at the world's largest annual sporting event, the Tour de France. I am talking about the ones who finish last. Also,
tu vas voir un monde que t'as jamais vu et t'aurais jamais dû voir. La crème de la crème.
Quoi comme genre de fille?
Bah je sais pas moi, t'aimes quoi?
Tout.
Bah on a tout.
We will find out whether a film on a prostitution ring in France's top business school is as inflammatory as it sounds. All that plus some music as well. That is Midori House with me, Markus Hippi, right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is Bill Bingham with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. South Korean prosecutors have asked for an arrest warrant to be issued for the captain of the ferry which sank, leaving 28 people dead and hundreds missing. It's been revealed a junior officer and not the captain was on the bridge of the MV Sewol when it capsized on Wednesday. Efforts to find the 268 people still missing have been hampered by strong currents and murky water. Coast Guard officials say two divers have managed to enter the cargo bay of the vessel, but they weren't able to rescue or identify anyone. A high school vice principal rescued from the capsized ferry has been found hanged. Police say 52-year-old Kang Min Kyu's body was found near the school gymnasium on Jindo Island, where many of the relatives and rescued people have been staying. Ukraine's interim authorities have appealed for national unity and promised to meet some of the demands of pro-Russian protesters in eastern Ukraine. Their demands include the decentralization of power and guarantees for the status of the Russian language. It follows the refusal by pro-Russian activists and militias to leave buildings they've been occupying. Earlier, Russia, Ukraine, the EU and US agreed in Geneva that illegal military groups in Ukraine must leave official buildings, but that there'd be an amnesty for anti-government protesters. Ukraine's foreign minister, Andrei Deshchitsia, says his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, has been in touch with local representatives in eastern Ukraine.
I don't know the Russian intentions. But Minister Lavrov did promise that they want a de-escalation. So we'll see in a few days if it was a sincere promise and sincere participation.
The oil giant Royal Dutch Shell has announced it's committed to expanding its business in Russia despite sanctions imposed on the country over its annexation of Ukraine's Crimea region. Chief Executive Ben Van Beurden told Russian President Vladimir Putin Shell has agreed with the Kremlin-owned Gazprom to expand their liquefied natural gas plant.
This is a special occasion for me to visit because indeed today is our 20th anniversary of the partnership that we have in Sakhalin Energy, a partnership that we are exceptionally proud of. I believe between the partners we have achieved a lot internationally in the Asian energy market, and recently when I was in Sochi, I agreed to take the project forward into a next phase.
A car bomb has exploded outside a mosque in the central Syrian city of Homs, killing at least 14 people. State television says the explosion happened as people left the Bilal al-Habshi Mosque in Akrama district after attending Friday prayers. The area is largely populated by President Bashar al-Assad's minority Alawite sect. At least 12 Sherpa guides have been killed after an avalanche swept down the slopes of Mount Everest. The avalanche hit an area just below Camp 2 at 6,400 metres on the most popular route to the summit. Helicopters and rescuers on foot have been sent to the scene and pulled 12 bodies from the snow and ice. Three others are believed to be missing. Two injured Sherpas have been taken by helicopter to hospitals in the capital, Kathmandu. Colombia has declared 3 days of national mourning following the death of the Nobel Prize-winning author Gabriel García Márquez at the age of 87. President Juan Manuel Santos has ordered all public buildings to fly the national flag at half-mast. Márquez, who won the Nobel Prize in 1982 for his novel 100 Years of Solitude, died in Mexico City. He's to be cremated in a private ceremony. Giorgio Armani has paid 270 million euros to the Italian authorities to settle a tax bill. A spokesman for the fashion house has confirmed reports the payment was in connection with the group's subsidiaries abroad. Last year, the designers Domenico Dolce and Stefano Gabbana were convicted of evading millions of euros in tax. They're appealing against a 20-month jail sentence. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Bill Bingham, and we will get more news headlines in 24 minutes. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We are back right after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18:06 and it is 13:06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio are journalist and commentator Samira Shackle and Darren McCaffrey, political journalist at Sky News here in London. Welcome both to the programme. Let's start with the latest developments on the Ukraine crisis. Ukraine, Russia, the European Union and the US have reached an agreement in Geneva on a series of steps to pull the country from the brink of war. The deal requires illegal groups to disarm and vacate the government buildings and public spaces they have occupied during the crisis. And in exchange, those illegal groups will be granted amnesty. But so far, pro-Russia separatists are standing their ground. If I start with you, Darren, what is your analysis of this situation? If the pro-Russia separatists are not disarming despite requests to do so by Russia, who can make them go?
Well, precisely. And it seems that this deal was struck with everyone but the pro-Russian separatists, who actually key to any agreement in the first place. And I think it leaves actually all sides in a really quite difficult place, in that these pro-Russian separatists seem pretty entrenched. They don't sound like they're moving anywhere anytime soon. And that then puts then Kiev in a really difficult position, because obviously they're calling for the removal of this interim government, which is not going to happen, certainly before the elections, which I think are planned for May. And so, what precisely can they do? I mean, does Kiev now then ramp up the force again, which potentially can antagonise Russia? But as you say, the pressure, I think, can only really come from Russia. But then yet again, that is yet more Russian intervention, which is not going to be terribly welcomed by those in the West or indeed those in Kiev.
Are you really thinking that Russian intervention is the only option?
I don't mean intervention necessarily in terms of kind of troops on the ground or any of that. I mean intervention in terms of pressure coming from Moscow. I think you're right that the only way that these pro-Russian separatists are going to disarm and move away, it is going to have to come from Moscow.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true, that you can't really deny the continued importance of Russia one way or another. And I think it was quite interesting in the US response, quite how explicitly John Kerry put that when talking about this deal, sort of saying quite explicitly that Russia was held responsible for providing weapons and organisation and so on to these pro-Russia separatists. So I think the sort of role of Russia is undeniable. I thought it was quite interesting as well that Putin was giving a sort of annual Q&A session in Moscow, and he was sort of going out of his way to sound like the peacemaker, saying quite reasonably, in fact, that, you know, the important sides to be talking to each other are Kiev and the separatists. But on the other hand, there were these sort of veiled threats. Was talking about his right to send in troops to Ukraine. And I think we also can't forget the fact that there still are tens of thousands of Russian troops amassed near the border.
At the same time,
Yeah, I was just saying that. I mean, that's the key thing in a sense, that it is all talk from Moscow, but very little action. We all know that. I mean, we've heard this word. How many times have we heard this word? We need to de-escalate the situation. Yeah. And yet, almost with every other sentence that then follows, it's escalated some more. And so, how can you expect Kiev to feel comfortable when you do have thousands of troops on your border? And I mean, it's pretty undeniable that Russia is at least supporting in some ways, or even potentially encouraging these pro-Russian efforts. I think it would be wrong to say, though, we have made a bit of progress. The fact that Ukraine, the Ukrainian government, is involved in talks with Moscow is a significant step.
And the fact that Russia has actually agreed on this deal, and now we have also Russia demanding and requiring that these groups actually disarm and vacate these buildings they've taken over. Do you think Russia is starting to feel its responsibility?
Well, I think Russia may feel, and Vladimir Putin may feel, that you can only push people so far. And it is incredible, actually, how Crimea is now not talked about. I mean, it is. I think John Kerry was asked about this yesterday. I mean, it is just an assumption that Crimea is probably now going to be part of Russia and remain so. But I think also Vladimir Putin is very aware that, I mean, the economy isn't in a good shape. We know that the stock markets of Moscow picked up yesterday at the hint of this agreement. And yes, his support has gone up in the country, but he also knows that he can really only push Western governments so far.
Yeah, I think it's also worth noting that by contrast to Crimea, I think the idea of joining Russia and joining Russia in these provinces is not gaining as much traction as it did in Crimea, and I think there's probably awareness of that in Moscow, and the deal that was agreed to in Geneva sort of does serve or could potentially serve Putin's interests to an extent, because it sort of allows for move towards further federalization of these regions, which would presumably allow those sort of decentralized regions to remain as close to Russia as they wish.
Well, I think Samir's picked up the key point is that we are talking about pro-Russian supporters, but we're not talking about many. We're not talking about the numbers of people that we saw on the streets trying to overthrow Yanukovych. I mean, this does seem to be, okay, reasonably well organized, in some cases well armed, but relatively small groups of people. And it doesn't seem that the communities come out in their droves to support.
Well, Ukraine's interim authorities have appealed for national unity, and they've actually promised to meet some of the demands of these pro-Russian protesters. And these things include the decentralization of power and also guarantees for the status of the Russian language. I assume you don't feel like that's going to be quite enough.
Well, no, I mean, I mean, whether it's enough for those pro-Russian separatists, many who seem to want to join it's somehow kind of some golden age era of the Soviet Union. But I think at the same time, actually, ultimately what these protests might do is they might lead to a better Ukraine in the long term. If they can get more devolved power, particularly to the eastern part of Ukraine, which we know it tends to be more Russian-leaning. It's got people of more Russian heritage, and the Russian language is spoken there more. So if we get to a situation, what we don't want is a situation that we saw with Yanukovych, where power was incredibly centralized and he acted as a kind of de facto dictator in lots of ways. Actually, if what we do get through these protests is a more devolved power system in Ukraine, that would probably do everyone in the country a world of good.
Now, our next story is both intriguing and terribly sad. A British teenager has died while fighting with rebel forces in Syria. He had fled his parents' home to join jihad fighters trying to topple Bashar al-Assad's government. He is part of over at least 600 Europeans reported to have joined extremist Muslim groups. So why are they taking part in a battle that is so foreign? Samira, if I start with you, what is your understanding of what's going on over here? First of all, how are these people recruited?
I think there's several things to note on that. So the first thing is that we've seen a greater influx of European fighters to Syria than in other sort of related conflicts or comparable conflicts like Afghanistan or Iraq. And that's probably largely to do with the fact that it is just easier to access Syria than it was to access Iraq or Afghanistan in the previous wars. And that's something that experts have kind of noted. It's just sort of simpler transit routes over land from Turkey or Lebanon. There's also the sort of greater prevalence of online recruitment. There's It's been called the, I think, one of the most sort of socially mediated conflicts in history in terms of sort of foreign fighters heading into Syria. So there's those two factors. I think also sort of from speaking to people who are studying the flow of foreign fighters into Syria, lots sort of advise caution that I think that not everyone who goes to fight in Syria from Europe is connected with a sort of radical extremist jihadist group or a group that has designs on attacks in the West.
So who are the ones who are not connected?
There's people who might be seeking a cause, people who are motivated by humanitarian aims or whatever, so sort of seeing the injustice in Syria and wanting to fight. And I think as the conflict is carrying on, I think it's probably more and more people who are connected to sort of radical elements in some way. But I think it's important not to overlook that other people do exist. And it's also, I think, that it's a sort of ready set narrative for a young Muslim man who might be disenfranchised. Okay, I'll just go to Syria. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's intent to carry out attacks.
And how does that online recruiting work? Do you know details?
I think it's a combination of things, really. It's the same as online recruitment to sort of terror networks always has been. There's a combination of it might be sort of people seeking things out themselves, so sort of seeking connections with sort of message boards, finding online communities. There's a lot through quite openly, actually, through Twitter and Facebook. There's people who are sort of European fighters who are already in Syria. It's quite astonishing, I think, the openness with which those people are happy to display their own faces, their own identities in order to recruit other people.
Darren, do you think there is a responsibility for European countries to try to prevent their citizens from going to Syria?
Well, there's been lots of talk about potentially trying to remove their passports or identity cards of young Muslim men that they may think are likely to go there. But however, I mean, there will be big civil liberty issues about that, and also the potential to antagonise. I think what is the kind of really interesting thing about this, we heard from the father today of this 18-year-old boy who died in recent weeks in Syria. And he said for Abdullah it was not enough just to donate money or baby milk. He felt he needed to do more, which kind of builds in Samara's argument about that it was, in a sense, it may be humanitarian. And we know that we've got to a stage now in Syria where al-Assad really has the upper hand and fighting is quite difficult, but there's still a big humanitarian situation. However, the father also went on to say that he died in battle. He died fighting against the dictator, but he was not a terrorist, which kind of brings us on to how these people, these young Europeans, from Britain, where I'm reading a report today about potentially up to 80 from Belgium alone who've gone to Syria to fight, about how they're described in the Western media and by Western governments. We've got Western governments who've given moral and non-military support to rebels in Syria. And yet, the way that these people have been described and how they may come back to Britain radicalised to be a threat to us, yet they seem to be fighting on the same side that we agree with.
Absolutely.
And also, I think the media's got a responsibility in this, that it is far too easy for us, because they're involved in armed conflict, to describe them potentially as terrorists. Yet at the same time, you could argue they're involved in a relatively legitimate uprising.
Mm. I think also in answer to your question, that I think it's always, of course, the government should encourage citizens not to go there because it's a huge, grave personal risk to themselves. I've actually interviewed a boy who went to fight in Syria and was very shocked by what he found. I think people might not be quite aware of the risks they're facing, and most are probably not going to come back alive or will do so with huge sort of emotional and physical scars. But I think there is also a risk of assuming that everyone, and not only just assuming that everyone who goes to Syria to fight is a terrorist, but also of viewing the conflict in Syria as a global terrorist problem, not as a civil war.
How real problem is it that when these people come back to Europe, then that is going to lead into an increased terrorist threat?
I think basically what that depends on is whether there is a group in the country which wants to target the West. And at the moment, you don't have that in Syria, but there's no saying that that won't develop. A study of sort of previous Islamic conflicts and foreign fighters found that I think fewer than one in nine went on to sort of be involved with radical elements in the West. But it's quite difficult to extrapolate from that.
But there is no doubt that certainly
Western governments do view this as a threat. Of course, we know that Europol have said that this is a major threat, and we know the government here in London are very concerned that you will have fighters coming back who may be radicalised not just by potentially Islamic extremism, but radicalised by what they've seen, which is a lot of violence, which changes people.
And at the same time, I feel like we should still remember that rebels in Syria are very radicalised. Al-Qaeda has a big role over there, and that cannot really be ignored.
No, it can't. But I do tend to agree that I think we've got to a stage of the conflict now where the fighting that we saw last year, the intensity of the fighting we saw last year, really has dissipated. And in part, that is because Bashar al-Assad really has got the upper hand in the conflict now. Of course, there are extremist elements, and it may be in part that the argument that Western governments would make is that the people attracted to Syria, who are radicalised often in Britain or Belgium or elsewhere, the reason they go is because they've been radicalised here, not necessarily there, and the radicalisation just gets exacerbated in Syria, so that the cause is already sold to them here before they go. Mm. And undoubtedly true. This has been a war that has been fought like no others in terms of TV coverage, in terms of social media, in terms of propaganda online, and that's a very powerful attraction.
Well, we are going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Markus Hippi, Samira Shackle and Darren McCaffrey. When we return, we'll discuss the progress of the nuclear talks between Iran and world powers, and we'll ponder why Pakistan has chosen to name one of its school libraries after Bin Laden.
24/7, 28 programs, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got The Curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
The beret is not just a French cliché. It's a cherished piece of heritage at risk of extinction. Monocle Films pays a visit to the last beret maker in France and meets an Irishman trying to revive this quintessentially French piece of headwear.
L'Olaire has now earned the label of Living Heritage Company, Entreprise de Patrimoine Vivant, a reward from the French government to salute a firm's excellence in keeping alive a unique tradition. As the last manufacturer of a product so deeply ingrained in French DNA, L'Olaire and its berets are worth fighting for.
Vive le Beret, premiering on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are journalist Samira Shackle and Darren McCaffrey, Sky News politics reporter. We were just talking about Syria, where the government has done all but keep its promises to the international community. Meanwhile, Tehran seems to be respecting its commitment to curb its nuclear program. According to the International Atomic Agency, Iran has neutralized half of its enriched uranium stockpile. As a result, the United States have announced they will release frozen Iranian funds. So, should we be cautiously optimistic? What do you think?
I think we should. I think we talk about intractable problems. We spent the first bit of the program doing precisely just that. But I think we too have to have a bit of optimism that Iran seems to be cooperating with the IAEA. And this is quite significant. We know that, I often remember having discussions not that long ago that Iran seemed like the biggest threat to stability in the Middle East and potentially the wider world. And yet here we are with the United States prepared to release Iranian funds because the Iranians are cooperating with the international community. Now, this does in part seem to have been aided along by Iran's new leader, which is good. And I have to say, actually, some credence probably has to give to Baroness Ashton, a woman very few people I've ever heard of, the highest paid female politician in the world. But she is actually, in a tenure which is now coming to an end, has doggedly pursued this, has gone to Tehran quite a few times, and it seems that, obviously with the cooperation of the United States, but that they have managed to make quite significant progress. Now, obviously, Iran is saying that they're not going to give up their nuclear ambitions. This is a step. And it may be also a testament to the fact that the Iranian economy is in a pretty, pretty dark
state. Exactly, exactly.
And this money is pretty essential.
Zamir, are you equally optimistic?
I think there's definitely a reason for optimism. If you've got... I think it would be naive to expect the US and Iran to suddenly hold exactly the same views on this. Mm-hmm. But I think that... that if there's a willingness from both sides to honour promises and work together, which there has been, then I think that's sort of a reason for cautious optimism. I think it doesn't solve the sort of longer term problem, which is that this is a sort of interim agreement. It's running out on the 20th of July. And in terms of a permanent agreement, as Darren said, Iran doesn't want to give up its nuclear programme. The international community would like to see a sort of permanent limiting of the nuclear programme, and how that's resolved will be interesting to see.
And at the same time, we should remember that Iran is not always the easiest part, and let's remember the row that's taking place between the US and Iran now about Iran's ambassador to the UN. Iran has nominated Hamid Abutalibi as its ambassador, and this is the very same man who supposedly was involved in the 1979 hostage crisis.
I was reading that his role wasn't sort of mastermind of the attack, so that's sort of an area for debate about how provocative that was. But certainly, I think there is there's definitely a sort of pride about Iran, and I think in some respects, I think that's sort of fair enough. That I think what Rouhani's having to work against, even in terms of having taken the agreement this far, is the sense. Among hardliners, but also among some sections of the population who aren't necessarily that hardline, this feeling that sort of, why should America tell us what to do, and isn't it our right to have this program and have these developments? So I think that's something to work against.
And let's not get too carried away. I mean, we have to remember, this is a positive step in the right direction. Iran is still very, very heavily involved in the Syrian conflict, which we've been talking about, very still heavily involved in Iraq, and obviously not to the desirable ends that the West would like. So we're not talking about a kind of new explosion of a friendship here. I think what we're talking about actually is pretty... gritty, realistic politics, which is Iran, doesn't want to be an absolute pariah in the international world, knows it has to integrate in some ways, desperately needs some money, and is willing to make some reasonable concessions to the United States in order to do that.
Let's finish with what's been going on in Pakistan. An Islamic seminary for women has been named after Osama bin Laden, no less. A sign on the school, which is linked to the famously extremist Red Mosque, describes the former head of Al-Qaeda as a martyr. Samira, what does this say about the state of affairs in Pakistan?
He's a sort of fairly marginal figure, I think. Maulana Abdullah Aziz, who's sort of made this move, and he's a cleric who's hardline, who's actually on negotiating at the moment on behalf of the Taliban in the talks that are going on between the government and the Pakistani Taliban. So I think it's quite clear sort of where his sympathies lie. I sort of wince when I see these stories come. Sometimes you think it's just such sort of it's obviously designed as a sort of provocative move, and that's what it's been, I think. But I think actually that the sort of response to it in the Pakistani press shows that this has really moved away from the mainstream, and I think that's quite a change over this sort of lauding of Osama bin Laden has moved away from the mainstream. I think there was probably a sense maybe 10 or 15 years ago to see him sort of because of the broad anti-American sentiment in Pakistan, there's sort of a tendency perhaps among greater parts of the population than there exists now to praise Osama bin Laden as someone who's standing up to the West, etc. But I think as there's been a greater and greater death toll from homegrown terrorism within Pakistan, I think that's sort of reducing. And now these moves like this library being named after him seem more and more marginal.
No, it should be said, we talk about a library, apparently this place has no chairs or any table, and it is two computers on the floor. so I'm not entirely sure what you go in
to
learn or to do. It is interesting, though. People who are now dead are still used to provoke effectively. I mean, and kind of drawing slightly back to kind of the Ukraine, how people like Lenin and Stalin are suddenly kind of coming out of the works for these pro-Russian supporters because it's seen as kind of provocative, kind of almost two fingers up at Kiev. And I think it is. When you look at calling the library Osama bin Laden, even in Pakistan, as Amir was saying, it is a very provocative thing to do.
Unfortunately, we have to leave it there already. Darren McCaffrey and Samira Shackle, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And there is plenty more to come on the second half of today's edition of Midori House. We will speak to our women in Caracas, we will review this week's new French films, and I will speak to author Max Leonard, who has written a book on those individuals who have finished last in the Tour de France. But before we get started on all that, here is Bill Bingham with the world news headlines.
South Korean prosecutors have asked for an arrest warrant to be issued for the captain of the ferry which sank, leaving 28 dead and hundreds missing. It's been revealed a junior officer and not the captain was on the bridge of the MV Seawall when it capsized on Wednesday. Efforts to find the 268 people still missing have been hampered by strong currents and murky water. Ukraine's interim authorities have appealed for national unity and promised to meet some of the demands of pro-Russian protesters in eastern Ukraine. Their demands include the decentralization of power and guarantees for the status of the Russian language. A car bomb has exploded outside a mosque in the central Syrian city of Homs, killing at least 14 people. State television says the explosion happened as people left the Bilal al-Habshi Mosque in Akrama district after attending Friday prayers. At least 12 Sherpa guides have been killed after an avalanche swept down the slopes of Mount Everest. The avalanche hit an area just below Camp 2 at 6,400 metres on the most popular route to the summit. Colombia has declared 3 days of national mourning following the death of the Nobel Prize-winning author Gabriel Garcia Marquez at the age of 87. President Juan Manuel Santos has ordered all public buildings to fly the national flag at half-mast. Giorgio Armani has paid €270 million to the Italian authorities to settle a tax bill. A spokesman for the fashion house has confirmed reports the payment was in connection with the group's subsidiaries abroad. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Bill Bingham, and welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, and today we head to Venezuela, to Caracas, for a check-in with our correspondent, Irene Caselli. Hello and welcome to the programme. So, protests and clashes have continued in Caracas. Could you give us the latest?
Yes, the latest is a bit of a twist that has to do with Easter here in Venezuela. You remember from these past few weeks, the protests here in Venezuela started in mid-February. And at this very moment, there is a dialogue ongoing between certain members of the opposition and the government to come to a resolution for these protests that have led to at least 40 deaths so far. But a certain sector of the opposition remains in the streets. So students have gone out throughout this week using the Easter theme. So they've gone out barefoot, they've built crucifixes, and they're also planning to burn effigies of the president to sort of play around the idea of Easter. The protesters have tried to be quite creative over these past couple of months of protests. For example, during Carnival, they dressed up and created beaches to simulate that they were out on the beach during the protests. And however, we need to say that the protests are becoming, as weeks go by, sort of smaller and smaller, and these Easter-themed ones haven't so far gathered so much support.
And you said there earlier that protesters have been getting smaller. Are you predicting now that situation is going to get peaceful?
It's very hard to tell because there seems to be a hardcore that seems very keen on continuing to be in the streets, and not everyone is backing the sector of the opposition that is actually carrying out dialogue with the government to try and find a solution to this unrest that has been going on for over 2 months already.
And moving on to your second topic, it's about the government as well, but it's a positive start, positive new initiative from the government. It is starting a new offensive to protect Venezuelan consumers from unscrupulous businessmen. So what kind of stories and what kind of cases have been reported there in the Venezuelan press?
Well, the Venezuelan press has been talking a lot about this issue, the issue of unfair prices. And actually, let's remember that last November, the president took this issue very seriously, and the government sent in the National Guard to occupy electronics stores. This happened just before Christmas, because they said that they were inflating the price of products. So this was a very successful initiative and gave Mr. Maduro a lot of backing during a period that he wasn't being so popular. So some critics are actually saying that the government may go back to such strong initiatives in order to find more backing among the population. Since protests started, actually, both the opposition and the government lost a lot of support according to several polls that have been carried out here in Venezuela. So the government may try to clamp down on more shops. They will be doing more inspections as days go by. So it remains to be seen what sectors they'll be tackling exactly. But supposedly right now there is a law in place. It's a law of fair prices, and this is how this is what they'll use to figure out which shops are not complying and which sectors they will come down on.
Let's finish then with another massive news story from your region. The death of Colombian writer Gabriel Garcia Marquez. How has that story been reported in the Venezuelan press?
Well, that story has been actually huge here in Venezuela. Colombia is Venezuela's next door neighbor. And Gabriel Garcia Marquez actually spent part of his career as a journalist here in Venezuela. So this is something that is very close for Venezuela, as for many other countries around the region. And the president paid his homage to Garcia Marquez, and he said that he was a very important figure for Latin America. He was a true backer of the region's true revolutions. And all the national newspapers have been titling, have been heading with that story for this past day or so. Even the protests and everything that is happening at a national level, in a way, seems to be less relevant compared to the news of the death of Garcia Marquez.
That was Irene Caselli, our woman in Caracas. Thank you very much for this. Up next, we'll speak to author Max Leonard, who has written a book
Perfect.
On Tour de France. Not concentrating on the winners, though, but the last-placed riders instead. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Marco Sippi. As in any sports in the Tour de France, the attention tends to go to the winners, but that is changing now. My next guest, Max Leonard, has just published the book L'Andin Rouge, which is all about the ones who have finished last in this world's largest annual sporting event. Welcome to the program, Max.
Thank you.
I think it's a great idea to take this kind of an angle to this sporting event. Where did you get this idea from?
Well, I guess the L'Andin Rouge has been a fan's favourite of the Tour for quite a long time, and I'd already had an idea that maybe he was a kind of heroic loser or kind of glorious failure. But a couple of years ago, I did an amateur sporting event where you get to ride one stage of the Tour de France. They close the roads for you, and there's thousands of people doing it. And this particular day in the mountains, it was a huge storm, horrible, horrible weather, and me and all my friends, we were totally underdressed and all got off our bikes and gave up. And really, that's where the idea came from, because the professionals in the race, and especially the L'Andin Rouge, you know, he just keeps on going. He doesn't give up.
And I think one very interesting question you ask in your book is that if you complete a bike race of over 3,000 kilometers, overcoming demanding weather conditions, physical agony and so on, can you actually be called a loser even though you may finish last?
Yeah, I think for me it was a really interesting way of trying to look at the ideas of success and failure, because the Tour de France is such a huge event and there's so much going on except for the race for the yellow jersey. I mean, if you look at the teams, there's 180 guys who line up at the start, more or less, and maybe only five of them realistically think they're going to win the yellow jersey. And some of the others may be going for a stage win, some may be going for the sprinter's green jersey or the King of the Mountains jersey, but really everyone else is there with very different objectives in mind. And so one of the L'Andin Rouge was a guy called Wim van Sevenant, a Belgian, and he was what they call a domestique, so he was a team helper working for his team leaders for 3 years during the tour. And he was actually the most times L'Andin Rouge of any rider, and he was L'Andin Rouge three times.
Really?
But in those years, his team leaders got the green jersey once, and they got on the podium for the general classification two times, and they won three or four stages. So even though he was last, I think you could probably say he did his job really well.
Let's talk about him and other cyclists who have finished last as well, but a bit later, because first I want to ask about, you know, how you did your research, how you found out about all these stories of these cyclists.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Tour de France publishes its official history, and even though the L'Andin Rouge is not an official prize, you get big long lists of the finishers every year. And then, you know, I did a bit of internet research to look at the names that I didn't know, to see what else they'd done in their careers, and if they'd done anything interesting, you know, what were their backstories. So that was maybe over 110 years, so 100 different cyclists, and then narrowed it down, found the people I thought were really interesting, went to do a lot of interviews with the guys who are still alive, Spent a lot of time in Paris in the Bibliothèque Nationale looking at old newspapers. Bought a lot of old magazines over the internet, and that was really where it came from.
So what kind of individuals are we talking about over here? Do they have anything in common?
I found them a very, very interesting bunch. And I suppose of all the guys I met, I was just really astounded by how nice they were and how well balanced and how kind of interesting, normal people they were. I mean, I suppose you have an idea that if you're going to be a great winner in any sport or any field of life, you might be obsessive, you might be a little arrogant or driven, or that's certainly the impression you get of some of the great cycling champions. But all these guys just were really, really nice, interesting people. And also, I don't think that they were very happy to talk to me about their Lanterne Rouge years, and they didn't seem to think it was a kind of failure or that I was mad to think about, you know, talking to them about it. But they were, it was something that happened in their life, and they sort of moved on from it.
Were they proud?
Yes, some of them were proud. Some of them were...
I would be if I cycled 3,000 kilometres.
Yeah, I mean, Wim van Sevenant, who I mentioned, he said that being Lanterne Rouge three times was his greatest achievement in cycling. And some of the others were, I guess, slightly ashamed to be coming towards the back of the pack. But certainly, I think for any cyclist, finishing the Tour de France is a big achievement.
By the way, do you get anything if you become Lanterne Rouge?
Well, it's never been an official prize, but the fans love it. I suppose it's that kind of feeling for the underdog. And so it's especially back in the 60s and 70s when salaries were very low for professional riders, and it was a very kind of precarious business to be in. People would race to be last because the fans loved you so much, and you'd get so much adulation that you'd be invited to a lot of races after the Tour de France. So you'd make a lot of money from appearance contracts.
Max, shall we concentrate on individual stories now? So why does one become Lanterne Rouge?
I suppose there's several reasons. I mean, as I mentioned, there's the domestique whose job it is to help his leader, and he would just put all his effort in every day to save his leader energy, essentially. So, you know, he'd go back to the car and be picking up water bottles. This is what Wim van Sevenant did, and there's loads of other examples. Or they'd sit on the front of the peloton the whole day and chase down attacks to make sure that nobody dangerous got into a winning position on the road ahead. Or they'd ride them up the hill as quickly as possible, ride in front of them in the wind so that they'd then be at the right point to, you know, launch their own attack on the mountain. But you could also look at the sprinters, who are, you know, incredibly fast, the fastest riders in the peloton over the short distance at the end of the stage, but who just really aren't very well made for riding up mountains in the same way that the climbers are. So often they lose a lot of time in the mountains and end up at the bottom of the general classification, even if, you know, they've maybe won a stage or two themselves.
There's also been one unfortunate case when someone took some sort of a drug cocktail that accidentally slowed him down quite a bit.
Yeah, it's an interesting fact, and it's quite a sad story because Philippe Gaumont was a French rider who grew up in the probably worst years of doping in French cycling or in cycling in general. And he was riding in the Tour in 1997, and I think he or his teammates had miscalculated the sort of drugs that he was taking that he was hoping would make him go faster, and actually it really slowed him down, and he gained a lot of weight, and he was just in a kind of terrible state for 2 weeks of the Tour and ended up near the back.
What about another sort of an unfortunate dope-related story? This cyclist who stopped for a bottle of wine and then things didn't go quite according to the plan.
Yes, that was a funny... That was, in fact, a guy called Abdelkader Zaf, who was one of on the first African team to ride the Tour. And he, in 1950, was riding in the south of France on a huge heat wave on a stage when there was a really big heat wave, and so I think him and a teammate got away from the peloton and got a really, really big lead on one particular stage. But then, even because maybe they were better habituated to riding in 40 degree heat, but then towards the end of the stage he started wiggling across the road, zigzagging. He was clearly dehydrated and suffering in the sunstroke, and he took a bottle from a spectator, assuming it was water, and he, well, this is how the story goes, and he drank the bottle, and actually it was wine. And, you know, for anyone with sunstroke and dehydration, that would be terrible. But Abdelkader Zef was Algerian and was a Muslim, and so he didn't touch alcohol. And so the story goes that he, you know, collapsed and was laid out under a tree. And, I mean, I think the facts are certainly... It's certainly true that he passed out on the stage and then got up and rode backwards. But the wine story maybe is a little bit of an embellishment, but it's a story we like to tell.
Oh, dear. Well, your listeners can read more about this story and many other stories from this book, Lanterne Rouge, The Last Man in the Tour de France. The book is out now, and the author was Max Leonard. Thank you very much for this interview.
Thank you.
And here on Monocle 24, we continue today's edition of Midori House with a bit of music. And let's stay in the topic of cycling. This is Kraftwerk with Tour de France. La Côte d'Azur et Saint-Tropez, Tour de France, Tour de France. Les Alpes et les Pyrénées, Tour de France, Tour de France. Dernière étape, Champs-Élysées, Tour de France, Tour de France. What you just heard was Kraftwerk with Tour de France, and you are listening to Monocle 24 Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. Like every Friday, we take you to the movies, now figuratively at least. Today we discuss the latest film releases in France with Slate France's culture editor Charlotte Pudlowski. Welcome to the program, Charlotte. Which film shall we start with?
Well, I think the first one is Qu'est-ce qu'on a fait au bon Dieu? It's an expression meaning, what in God's name have we done to deserve this? And it's a movie by Philippe de Chauveron. And the plot is two white Catholic bigoted parents who raised four beautiful girls, three of whom are already married to an Arab, a Jew, and a Chinese guy, and they finally snap when their youngest chooses to marry a black guy. And the twist here is when we finally meet the black guy's parents, who came all the way over from the Ivory Coast, and they are just as racist as the white girl's parents. And even though I have to admit I laughed at some of the jokes, overall it is a very bad movie. But to be honest, when I saw it, I have to say the spectators around me were not as picky as I am. And I went to see it in a movie theater in a mixed neighborhood. And in the theater, there were people from all origins, white people, black people, Arabs, and kippah-wearing Jews. And they were laughing out loud. Everybody was. And they could not stop laughing. And you could see the various ethnic groups in the theater laughing every time a joke was aimed at them.
Exactly. And, but at the same time, you hated it.
Yeah. No, but I hated it because, and that's another interesting point in the movie, it doesn't only feature two generations of characters, but also two generations of comedians. The old one, represented by Christian Clavier, and they came from sketch comedy, and they have enjoyed massive successes in past decades, and the new one that comes from stand-up. And this movie clearly ended is the paradigm shift currently occurring from safe middle of the road, but slightly outdated comedy to fresher, edgier stuff that we would like to see more of.
So, Charlotte, we do have a clip of this film. Let's listen to it now.
Si on les invitait à Noël.
Comment ça, on va passer Noël chez tes parents?
On évite tous les sujets qui fâchent, hein? Israël, le Dalai Lama, la burqa.
Il y aura Jackie Chan et Arafat?
Il y aura Kadhafi, Enrico Macias?
Dis pas qu'il y aura Bruce Lee et Popek.
Surtout, pas un mot sur l'équipe de France de foot.
So that was the film, Charlotte, you didn't like, and that also has a sort of name I can't really pronounce. How many points would you give it?
Well, I wouldn't give it many points, but it's going to be a huge hit on box office. It's been the better opening since Intouchable, which was, or you know, the better opening we ever did in France. So,
let's continue with another film then. This is Le Gazelle, and let's listen to a clip of it straight away.
Et tout le monde s'inquiète pour toi.
Je suis célibataire, hein. Je suis pas malade.
So, Charlotte, what's going on over there?
Well, you know, we are longing in France for American comedy's talent when dealing with young women, their lives and their yearnings, and that's exactly what we're hearing in this clip. That was, you know, young girls talking about their life and there's, you know, in the U.S. they have girls on television, and there's been bridesmaids on the big screen, and there are all these stand-up and sketch comedy geniuses like Tina Fey. And in France, we had nothing. We've had a series of attempts in movies and TV and even comic books, but none had been really convincing. And now Menashe, this film's director, she seems to say, hey, this is happening, finally. And so this is the story of a 30-something girl, Camille, breaking up a 14-year relationship, which is a lot, and suddenly she's pushed in the deep end of the life of a single woman. And it's sad and it's a bit depressing. I mean, you know, she has to deal with a lot of loneliness, a lot of anxiety, but it's still much darker than a Judd Apatow movie, because beyond all those issues, you can feel a real sense of distress, a deep loneliness that is almost ontological, you know. And if I have time, I mean, I'm not sure it will sound funny if I tell it to you like that, but the movie is full of very good punchline, and at some point Camille sleeps with a guy and he can't get it hard on, and after failing to get it up by frantically masturbating, he goes, can I just watch you pee? And I can tell you there is a lot of fun, absurd, sincere tone about the movie that is really lovely and really comforting for French cinema's future.
Charlotte, just a quick question. How many guys did you have watching the film when you were in cinema?
Not enough, I think, but they should go, definitely.
And how many points on the scale from 1 to 10?
On 1 to 10, I would give a good 8, I think.
Great. We still have one film we need to talk about, and let's listen to a clip of it straight away. This is La Crème de la Crème. Tu vas voir un monde que t'as jamais vu et que t'aurais jamais dû voir. La crème de la crème.
Quoi comme genre de fille?
Bah je sais pas moi, t'aimes quoi?
Tout.
Bah on a tout.
So this film has been inspired by the best French business school. What exactly is going on over there?
Well, it's a business school, and it's basically the story of two losers, a boy and a girl, who partner with a cool kid to start a prostitution ring inside the school. And Kim Chapiron, the movie maker, the director, he spent a lot of time in the real school it is based on, and you can really sense the realism. I mean, it's a lot of sectarianism, the sense of belonging to the top elite. You even have the expression in English, right? La crème de la crème, it does exist. And you can sense the craving for fun, for sex, for debauchery, alongside the fact that most kids in these institutions come from rich and conservative backgrounds. And for instance, even though the whole movie is about sex and prostitution, there is almost none on the screen, and it feels like some kind of filter of protection. You know, you can talk about it, but acting on it is different. So I really liked the realism of the movie, but I also liked the naive but sincere thoughts on capitalism. The starting point of the prostitution ring is an observation. Some people are worth more than others on the beauty and sex market, and the girls offered to the guys are a product to satisfy the demand. And Chapiron, the director, he shows the cynicism of the kids. They're only students, and they already get offer on demand, mm-hmm. and how everything is a product with a price tag, even women. And yeah, I really like that.
How many points?
I would give it a 6.5.
That's great. Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. That was Charlotte Bulowski, culture editor for Slate France. Thank you very much indeed. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Samira Shackle and Darren McCaffrey, who joined me to discuss the latest developments in Ukraine and ponder why Pakistan has felt the need to name one of its libraries after Bin Laden. Today's show was produced by Daphne Denis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Michaela Aitken and Janie Cho. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. This show is back on Monday at the same time, but for this edition of Midori House, it is goodbye. Thank you for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.